Political engagement is essential to the political empowerment of the African American and Latino communities. And there are so many ways to be engaged.
Welcome to the Empowerment Zone with Ramona Houston, where we zone in on Black and Brown relations and our journey to empowering our communities.
Today, I talked to Dr. John Eaves, former chair of the Fulton County Board of Commissioners and candidate for Georgia's Secretary of State. As Dr. Eaves explains, political engagement extends beyond the vote. In fact, according to Dr. Eaves, political engagement consists of four primary pillars. Enjoy our conversation and see the show notes for more information about Dr. John Eaves. As always, make sure you subscribe to the Empowerment Zone podcast and give us a rating on Apple Podcasts. Your support will make sure that we continue our journey in empowerment and impact.
Dr. Houston, thank you so much. I'm looking forward to a very thoughtful conversation today with you and your listening audience.
Well, thank you so much for joining me. You know, here at the Empowerment Zone, we're all about empowerment and impact, and you've been very influential in the political empowerment of people in our area, in Atlanta, in Fulton County, and in the state. I know you're running for office, which may go into a runoff, but can you tell us a little bit about, you know, your race and why you are running for Georgia Secretary of State and what you want to see in that role? And then let's talk about some of the challenges that are facing African-American and Latino voters as we continue our quest for the political empowerment of our communities.
Yeah, so it's a great first question. So let me just tell you a little bit about my background. Of course, you know me, but your audience may not. So as you indicated, served as the chairman of Fulton County government, and the county government is an extension of state government, and Georgia has 159 counties, and Fulton County is the largest of all those counties, 1 million residents, 15 cities within the county, and that county government provides a wide range of services to constituents or people, criminal justice, the elections process, senior services, youth services, public health, among others. So I did that for 11 years. And prior to that, our paths crossed during higher education days. Worked at Spelman College, currently now as an instructor in the political science department. I'm the former regional director of Peace Corps, so I have an international perspective. I've traveled extensively around the world to 52 different countries and counting. Also the proud parent of two college-age students, who are actually now graduate level students. My daughter graduated from North Carolina A&T recently, and she's gonna perhaps go into the Morehouse School of Medicine. And my son is completing his first year in the School of Global Health at Duke University. Mm-hmm. And I'm also a small business owner. So all of that really ties into what I am endeavoring to do, running for the chief election officer in the state of Georgia, and that's called the Secretary of State. That's one of several prominent responsibilities, but the major responsibility that most people think about is elections, which is the bedrock of our democracy in terms of everyone being able to participate who's an American citizen, 18 years old and above. It is their ticket, it is their voice, it is their opportunity to have representative government to articulate and defend and champion issues that people have on both the local, state, and federal level. But this position is arguably one of the most important positions in the state of Georgia. Again, as Secretary of State, I'm very excited about my candidacy.
Congratulations. So tell me, what is it that you're seeking to accomplish in that role?
Yeah, you know, it's a multifaceted role, and there are several things I want to accomplish. Certainly voting and making sure that everybody who's eligible to vote and wants to vote can vote. unfortunately, in this country, everyone doesn't quite see that way, especially for those of us who are Black and brown. I'm a Democrat, and we believe that the Republican Party and some members of the party are making it difficult for Black and brown communities to vote. So I want to make sure that everyone has the ability to vote and their vote is protected. So when they cast a vote on election day or early voting, it counts. So that's first and foremost my priority. But there's some other things that are associated with the office that are very important. Don't necessarily get as much attention, but they are very important. Some of these are what I call meat potato issues. These are issues that are deal with finances and your income and your revenue. And I know you've had some experience as a small business owner, I am as well. And so Secretary of State is responsible for what's called the Corporations Division. And any business entity in the state of Georgia who wants to operate in a legal way must be registered with the Secretary of State. They must be a registered legal or a registered entity so that they can do work, so that they can procure services, so that they can transact businesses. And so there are 1.1 million small businesses in Georgia, and many of them fail. So I want to make sure that small business owners like you and me and others are successful in our endeavors to be our own breadwinner and to control our own destiny and to get paid for work that we perform as opposed to working for somebody else. And quickly, there are two other areas of responsibility, major areas of responsibility for the Secretary of State's office is licensing. So if you're a professional, what's called an occupational professional, nurse, doctor, architect, welder, electrician, plumber, many of these professions have what they call certification requirements. You can't just say, I'm gonna be a doctor and just start doctoring on people. You got requirements that you got to fulfill. And so each profession has a board that certifies Dr. Houston, Dr. Eves, Dr. Jones, et cetera. And if somebody is not compliant with the certifications, they can lose their license. And so the Secretary of State's office actually convenes all of these licensing boards. There's 42 of them in Georgia. And so that's an important role. And the third area is the securities area. These are financial transactions, financial institutions, private equity financing, et cetera. And that's another area that's very important, but a lot of people don't think about it. So during the course of this interview, we certainly can talk about some of those areas. But my two biggest priorities are the voting, the elections, as well as business development for small business owners.
So let's talk about, as you know, it's all around the news, this threat to the Black and brown vote in particular, all these proposals to change how elections are done in various states throughout the country are a threat to African-Americans and Latinos being able to count to cast our vote. And like you stated, most importantly, for our votes to count. Can you kind of give us some context on what is going on and why African-Americans and Latinos need to be proactive about challenging the various laws or proposed laws, if you will, that are going on in around the country instead of waiting until after the fact to try to make something happen? What do you think we need to be doing now?
Yeah, so great question. Let me put it into a context. And so the United States of America is one of the most diverse countries on the planet. And we have Black and brown people, as we call it now, but these are people of African descent, people of Latino descent, Spanish descent. And to me, that's the strength of the United States is our diversity, the growing Latino population and the longstanding African American population. That's the strength of our country. And those numbers are growing and is becoming a significant block of voters that have political influence. And we saw it in 2008 with the election of Barack Obama. We've seen it most recently with the election of Joe Biden. And we've seen it on state and local levels across the country. And I teach political science just like you used to teach, I think, history. And I tell my students that elections, voting, elections, representation is also connected to economics. And so the Browning of America, as we currently talk about, and the Browning of America that has been predicted for the past 20, 25 years is now coming to reality. And there happens to be a conservative group of people in this country who feel threatened by the growing Browning of America. And these folks are, many of them are conservative members of the Republican Party. Many of them are white. Now, of course, they're white people who also see the value of diversity and embrace it, but there are some who don't. And so these challenges with voting, elections, the laws that are being passed in places like Georgia and Texas and some other states around the country, they are designed to make it more difficult for Black and Brown communities to actually cast the vote. Laws, regulations of voting have become stricter. There's an environment of confusion. There's a toxic environment of division that's been fanned by the former president of the United States, who in the summer of 2020 started talking about elections being fraudulent, even as he was about to be on the ballot. He began the conversation. And unfortunately, when you have a person in a position of influence and power as he was and still has, it has an impact on a lot of people, not just ordinary people who think that there's something about fraudulent elections, thousands and thousands of immigrants voting, people voting on behalf of dead people, all this type of crazy stuff that's being said, but it also impacts legislators on the state level who have been motivated, misled to come up with these laws that arguably are making it more difficult for some people to vote specifically Black and Brown people. So that's what's happening. And it is about representation, is about the ability for Black and Brown communities to vote and have people who look like them and who are gonna protect their interests and make sure that they get fair and equal access to policy, the benefits of policy, programs and services, allocation of resources that go into their community versus somebody else's community. That's what this is all about. And we just need to be honest about it. And I don't mind being honest about it. And so we have to make sure that we as voters are aware of some of the shenanigans, some of the challenges that are being placed before, some of the decisions that are being made. And I tell people all the time, Black and Brown people just want to be at the table. I think you mentioned this in your intro. We just want to be at the table. We just want to be fair, you know? And unfortunately, there's some people who don't want us at the table, want us to continue to get the short end of the stick, wanted us to continue to get the economic crumbs from the table, but that's not right. So that's what we're doing. We're fighting. We should fight for what we believe we should get. And that's our share.
So what do you think that, you know, people are always talking about whether they're community organizers or they're people who are running for elective office or who are in elective office are always saying, hey, we need to fight for our rights or what have you, but they're never specific on what that means. Yeah. How do you think that African-Americans and Latinos can become more engaged in the political process?
Great question. So there are three ways that people can get involved, maybe even four ways. I believe that the most basic way that you get involved is voting. It's the most basic and the easiest. One person, one man or woman, one vote. That's the most basic. Everybody should be able to do it. There's no excuse for that, not doing it. Then there's something called activism. Activists go out the street and protest and try to rouse up folks, get media attention to promote their cause, to fight for voting access. And activism does work. Activism has been able to stop local election boards from making it difficult for people to vote. Some of the local election boards in Georgia have considered reducing the number of precincts for people to vote. In some of our more rural communities where they only have about 5 or 7 precincts, and there is a county and people are spread out around the county, some of the local election boards want to reduce the precincts down to 1. But local people fought back, made a bunch of noise, were activists, and the local boards changed their minds. So activism does work. Number 3, there's something called advocacy. And advocacy, in my opinion, is where you actually go before elected officials, meet with them in their office, talk about policy that can be developed, policy that can be supported, and influence legislators, influence local officials by talking with them one-on-one or as a group. For me, as a chairman of Fulton County, did it for 11 years, as I mentioned in my intro, sometimes people coming in my office were able to get things done by advocating on A, B, and C. And I said, okay, I'll do it. And I'll come up with the legislation, the policy, and get my colleagues who are elected officials to support it. So you have voting, you have activism, you have activism and advocacy. The last piece is actually running for office. So quick 15-second story. I used to do a lot of community work and, you know, clothing drives, food drives, helping people who are homeless. And I had an uncle who was in politics in his career. He saw me doing community work, said, that's a great thing that you're doing, John. But believe it or not, if you're an elected official, instead of helping 50 people here, 50 people there as a local community activist, you can pass legislation that can impact thousands and millions of people. And so when you're an elected official, you're in the position to really through public policy. I know I sound like an academic professor here, but you can develop rules and regulations and policy that impact a wide range of people when you pass it. So just sort of on the fly, based on the great question that you've asked, I think people can get involved in those 4 ways, voting, activism, advocacy, and running for office and being in office.
I think those are great ways to be politically engaged. And like I said, a lot of people talk in these abstract terms without telling people some specifics on what they can do to be engaged. So thank you for those 4 ways. So what would you say to people who are really pessimistic and want to remain on the margins of politics and government and don't want to be engaged because they feel like their vote doesn't matter or that their voices are not heard? What would be the argument you would give them to convince them that they do need to be politically engaged?
Yeah, 2 things. We all heard the old saying, the empty wagon makes the most noise. That's sort of a negative comment, but the point is people who make noise are heard. And, you know, you just can't be on the sidelines at a football game and not cheer, you know? You have to make noise. You have to be seen. You have to be heard. And that's just inexcusable to just sit on the sidelines in our society and see things that are going wrong and maybe complain within your own heart, but don't do anything. So you gotta do something. The other thing is people don't realize how politics impacts your everyday life in many ways. Even if you have a good paying job or you, your own business owner, whatever, you think you're independent, you think you're autonomous. Well, hell, you walk down, you go leave your house and there's a pothole in the street. Who are you gonna call? You're gonna call city government. Traffic lights malfunction. Who are you going to call? You're going to call somebody. Somebody gets sick in your household. You call 911, and the 911 dispatcher is a part of government. And the police or fire department that come to your house, they're part of government. So people are impacted in every way, almost every way conceivable. And so you must be involved because those problems, those actions, those services are connected to your representation, and you vote to have your representation. And trust me, based on my experience, if you don't have anybody who is elected who is sympathetic and understanding of your needs, they will vote counter to your needs and somebody else. And so you got to have people who are going to be there representing you, making decisions on your part, because it does have an impact on your life.
You are so right. And that was a great argument that politics impacts every aspect of our lives. And we need representatives who actually speak to our interests and who are sympathetic to our interests in our communities. And that is not to say that African-American representatives or Latino representatives are the only ones that can speak on our behalf. We need people and elected representatives, public servants who can speak for all communities in ways that are empathetic and in ways that are really creating policy to make a positive impact on people's lives. And I think that's one of the things we need to begin arguing to people, that we can't stay on the sidelines, like you stated, in terms of being silent, that if we need to get in the game, basically.
I agree. You know, I went to Morehouse graduation and Reverend Raphael Warnock, Senator, speaking, and he talked about how he was a keynote speaker at Morehouse College, and he talked about how he was advocating for more funding for HBCUs, and he's very confident he's going to get it. Well, he's a product of an HBCU. He's a product of Morehouse College, and he's in office, and his predecessor, who was in office, did not advocate for HBCUs. And so there's a difference when you, and I'm a product of HBCU, you taught at HBCU, you went to Clark Atlanta, Clark College, one of the two. And we know how important these institutions are, and but they don't get as much support as they should. But now we have a representative on the federal government who's advocating for HBCUs. Doesn't mean somebody else may not, but definitely somebody who's a product of would be more passionate about it.
You know, that is a great example to use. And thank you for providing that example to make it more concrete of why it's important. Historically, HBCUs, meaning historically Black colleges and universities, Raphael, Senator Warnock is one of my classmates. We've been friends since we were freshmen in the Atlanta University Center. And it is good to know that he is advocating on behalf of historically Black colleges and universities. And it does make a difference, as you stated, but his predecessor did nothing for HBCUs. And so you need people in office who are really interested in making an impact on communities, and particularly communities who are considered marginalized. So looking, going back to your race, we do predict that you may go into a runoff. I know that in terms of percentages, that African-Americans and Latinos don't come out during runoff elections a lot. And it's already a low turnout during midterms. So what do we need to do to make sure that our numbers are up and that we are actually engaged in runoffs and in midterm elections?
Yeah. So within Georgia, for elections, no matter how many people are running for a particular race, the winner has to have 50%. So half of the vote plus one person at a minimum. If you don't get 50% and there are more than two people in the race, you have the two top vote getters go head to head, and that's the runoff. And so we do have a tremendous drop off in terms of voting participation from the primary or even general election and then the runoff. That's in most cases. It's not always that way, mm-hmm. but most cases it is. And so it's important for voters it's important for residents or citizens to vote every time and see it through, because the person that you vote for in the primary may or may not come in first or second, let's say may come in first place, but that person won't win or be elected to office unless he or she wins the runoff as well. So it's not enough just to vote in the primary. You need to vote in the runoff. Or it's not enough to vote in the general election and it happens to be a runoff and you need to vote in the runoff as well. So whenever that 50% plus one threshold is not attained, you're gonna have a runoff and people need to vote in both races.
And every state is not like that, is right. No. Georgia, we are the 50 plus one percent percentile, correct? I mean, right. 50 plus one to win a race.
Yeah. So I'm not sure if it's the right term, but I think it's plurality. So if there are multiple people in the race, let's say three or four people running, and you don't get 50, and no one person gets 50%, the person who gets the highest vote total can be the winner. And I think that's called a plurality race. And but that's in certain states and certain jurisdictions, but it's not Georgia.
Ours is majority.
Right, it's majority.
Correct. So when we look at African Americans and Latinos in terms of political office, in terms of being politically engaged and politically empowered, you talked about voting, activism, advocacy, and running for office. Is there anything else you would say that we need to do in terms of projecting our political power during this historical moment? You know, people say we've never been here before, but we've been here before during Reconstruction. Post-Reconstruction era, when the franchise was taken away and other events were happening. What do we need to do to make sure that we don't revisit that era again in American history?
Yeah. So I'm going to come up with two ideas that are not necessarily connected, but they still answer your question. Number one is, I do believe Black and Brown communities need to think in terms of financial giving and support of campaigns. When you run for office, you actually develop almost a small business operation to help you win. You hire staff who help you do the tasks, do jobs. You also have to raise money to provide funding for voter outreach, mailers, and telephone calls. And so, unfortunately, in American society, in a lot of cases, the campaigns that win, the people who raise the most money win. It doesn't happen all the time. In fact, hopefully, even in my race, that's not the case because one of my opponents has outraised everybody, and hopefully I will beat that person. But beat the person in the election. So I would say fundraising, contributing monies to campaigns. You have a stake in the candidacy and you actually can have some influence. Money influences politics. As long as you play within the rules, it's legal. When you go outside of the rules, that's when you have a problem. When you go outside of the rules, that means expecting what's called a quid pro quo. I give you some money, you deliver a contract to me when you get in office, that's illegal. But as long as you're supporting somebody because you want that person to be elected, it's legal, but it also gives you some degree of connectiveness with the elected official, and there's nothing wrong with that. All right, the other thing I think is important for your audience to know about is something called coalition building. So Black people, Brown people, as individual groups, may or may not be able to elect people of their choice. However, if there's a coalition of supporters, in some cases, Black and Brown, being a coalition to support a candidate can deliver representation or partnering with other groups whether it's members of the labor community, the LGBTQ community, it can be soccer moms, female groups. So I think coalition building. So as a candidate, you may want to think about coalition buildings. What groups of people coming together and getting behind you can get you elected, as well as groups identifying other groups who can get behind certain candidates who will then represent their cause. So again, it's two different ideas and suggestions. One is financial contributions to a campaign and the influence that you can have being a stakeholder behind a candidate. And then the other ideas is just one of a coalition. So Barack Obama in 2008, when he was elected, he didn't just get elected by Black people. So it was called the Obama Coalition. The Obama Coalition was Blacks, Latinos, some Asians, LGBTQ, and progressive whites. And that was basic coalition. So Black people, as you know, is only about 13% of the American population. Latino population is about 16-18% growing. But each of those groups in themselves cannot get somebody elected across the country. You have to add those numbers up. So 90% of the Black folks voted for Obama, or thereabout. Maybe 75-80% of the Latinos voted for President Obama or Senator Obama. And those numbers added up, and it became a coalition of voters that put him over the top to win. So I think coalition building is an effective way to get elected.
I really appreciate you bringing forth those ideas about the importance of financially supporting candidates, as well as building coalitions for candidates. And I was thinking the same thing as you when you were talking about it. I was thinking about the Obama example in both contexts. A lot of people, one of the ways that Obama changed the game was not only through the Obama Coalition, but how he engaged small donors, which had never been done before in politics. Now everybody's doing that. Right. But it used to be only the big money people that would give to campaigns. And now you see people in the communities being able to contribute in their own ways, whether it's which many politicians may consider them small gifts, but a lot of small gifts add up. And so Obama is a great example of both of those, coalition building and getting the masses to support his campaign.
Yeah, you know, the other thing I'm gonna tell you a little secret is that when people give to your campaign, they also, generally speaking, eventually vote for you. So I'm actually in the process of calling people who have contributed to my campaign and asking them to vote for me. I said, John, I gave you money. What do you expect? I want you to win. So people don't just give you money just because. They give you money because they want you to win it. So they're going to vote for you too. So those small dollar donations are not only effective in terms of getting money into the door or the budget, I mean, the bank, but it's also, these are people going to eventually vote for you. Yeah, that little $5, $6 you pay, you go, then you go to, then you go vote.
Yes. Like yourself, I'm a big advocate for higher education. And so I always like to ask my guests, what are their strategies that they would give students to ensure that they are successful in college? So what college or colleges did you attend? What were your major or majors? And what were your degree or degrees? And then what strategies would you give students to ensure that they're successful in college?
Gosh, that can be an episode in itself. So I got my bachelor's of arts in mathematics from Morehouse College, master of arts in religion from Yale University, and my PhD in education administration from the University of South Carolina. No real connectedness between all those degrees, but it still has kind of shaped me with who I am. And, you know, interestingly, at Morehouse College, where I got my start. I wasn't the best student. I was a good student. I was heavily involved in campus. I was a football player, member of the SGA, heavily involved in the community. And I actually graduated with a 2.8 GPA. And I had a good friend of mine who encouraged me to apply to Yale University. He was a student there. And I said, I don't think I can get in. I just have a 2.8. And I told my father that. He said, don't deny yourself an opportunity without trying. And so I tried, I applied, but I also went up to the school and interviewed, and I sold myself because of all the other great experiences I had at Morehouse outside of the classroom. And when I got into Yale University, arguably the second most prestigious school in the United States, I did really good. I did just as good as those students who went to Harvard and Yale as an undergraduate student. And then I did well also at the University of South Carolina. So I tell college students, I tell high school students to aim high in terms of the type of college or university you want to apply to. Look at a school that has a good fit with you. There's so many colleges and universities in the United States, over 3,000, I believe. And there's some schools that are very good fit for you. So do your homework and choose schools. You have predominantly white institutions, you have predominantly Black institutions, you have Hispanic serving institutions, you have private schools, you have public schools, you have Catholic schools, you have all types of schools. You have community colleges, you have four-year schools. So there's so many that you can choose from, but I think that, you know, doing your homework, making a choice, and I tell you, just make the most of the experience while you're there. Not only the academic rigors to be smart and have some competence in terms of a profession, but develop soft skills, and soft skills are people skills that you can develop while you're in college. Interpersonal skills, communication skills, writing skill may be a hard skill, but develop those skills while you're there. And I'm a big proponent of higher education. I think that gives you a leg up. Try to keep your debt low in terms of if you have to borrow money. But you know what? If you don't go to college, even though I'm a big proponent of, if you don't go to college, that doesn't mean that you can't be a successful adult. There are technical colleges, there are vocational schools, or you can go straight to the workforce and work and, you know, roll up your sleeves, maybe get some training while you're in that profession or that job. So I'm a big proponent, but going to college is not necessarily for everybody. It doesn't mean that you can't be successful if you don't go. But if you do go, make the most out of it and have a good time while you're there.
This is great advice. Thank you so much. Aim high. Look for a school that's a good fit for you. Make the most out of your experience by developing your hard skills and your soft skills. Make sure you keep your debt low. And college is not for everyone, but that does not mean you cannot be successful. You can be successful whether you have a college degree or you don't. And if you don't have one, you can still continue your education through continuing education programs. Yep. Thank you so much.
My
great
pleasure.
Advice.
Great. This has been great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
A special thank you to the incredible team of the Empowerment Zone. Terry Ungully, theme song, NADWORKS, digital support, and of course, our featured guest.
If you enjoyed my podcast, please subscribe. We are on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Be sure to rate us on Apple Podcasts too. Thank you for your continued support.